I want to introduce Eileen Workman, who first of all is a soulmate in transformation of society, and author of Sacred Economics, the Currency of Life. And I want to begin with a poem that I put on the website that we have. This is something that's unfolding. It's her and me, and you, and everyone else who wants to see how to get from the capitalistic system that is a win-lose game to life on life's terms. So this is a glimpse of a sacred economy. Just how long will we continue doing what we're doing as our attention is diverted and our energy drained by a controlling elite who are trying to get all the money in the world? Let's let them have it. All of it. Let's start helping each other to mix and match and organize and inventory what we have into a digital system and distribute according to need and creative potential. Let's let go of ownership and debts and bills and stocks and bonds and all containers of hoarded money. We are already connected in one internet around the globe and in an energetic heart field and in a conscious mind field. We have quantum communication of emotion and information and a money-based for-profit machinery, which is stripping the earth and her people of our natural resources. Let's let go of it all together, at once, and begin redesigning with what we have, which is all we need, a sacred economy based in the earth's abundance and our collective creativity for the awesome blessing of all life. Eileen?
Oh, look at all your faces. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and be present with you today. I loved Len's meditation.
Can everybody hear her?
No.
Okay. I'm a soft speaker.
Yes, you are. Is this on? Michael, do you know how to?
No.
The mic is on.
Well, I mean, it's on, but. So there's some main switch somewhere. Please.
While you talk, let me have this.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I'll talk loud while we're waiting. To give you a brief background on who I am and why I'm here is I spent 16 years as a stockbroker working in the financial services business, and I made lots and lots of money and I was extraordinarily unhappy. So I hit a point in my life where I said I have to figure out what's wrong, because obviously I've played by the rules and I've done the game the way I'm supposed to do it, and on the outside I'm a success. And on the inside, I'm a miserable human being. So there's something that's not functional about the system. So I took some time, I took time off work, and I went home and I started reading and studying and exploring and going into myself through meditative processes. And I had what I would call a spiritual crisis slash awakening, where I woke up literally one day and I said, oh my God, we're doing it all wrong. This is not who we are. And I've been playing this game that is not helpful to humanity, it's actually damaging humanity and damaging the planet. And things need to change, and they needed to change with me first. I recognized that what I was doing was harmful. And from that point forward, I went out and quit my job cold turkey, went back to work and said, I can't do this anymore. I don't believe that this system is life-affirming. I think we're aiming for the wrong things. And I spent the next couple of years writing the book that I've written, which is called Sacred Economics. The underlying premise of Sacred Economics, does everybody know what economics means? When I say the word economics, what comes to mind? What's the first thing that comes to your head?
Money.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, well, we think of money first because we've been trained to believe that economics is about money. The word economics actually comes from the Greek, and it means home maintenance. When you put that in the context, home maintenance. So, home maintenance. So when you put that in the context, what is it that the economy is supposed to be doing? It's supposed to be helping us maintain our home. And what is our home? Our shared home is this planet. And who are the people that live in this home? All the humans on this earth and every single animal and creature that lives on this earth. And as I began to conceptualize and realize what that meant, the word sacred came to mind. Because it became clear to me that everything is alive and everything is connected, and this is one large home that we're all sharing, and that reverence for that home was the key. And how we related to each other in right relationship in the context. Is that on?
Yeah.
Okay.
But hold it close.
Hold it close. In the context of that home became the key. So from where I stood, the way that we were managing economics and what we were talking about was far too narrow of a perspective for us to do it right. Everybody was focused on what we can afford and what we can't afford and how much money we're going to earn, and it's a win-lose game. And so all of these things popped up, and I said, you know, it's time for somebody to tell a different story, to reframe that story in a different way, starting from that larger perspective of what we really are and who we really are. And so that's what I've attempted to do with the book. And I'd like to read one small passage before we get started in a dialogue. I need my glasses.
I mean, can you turn off that flickering light? You turn the thank you.
It's all down. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
That's why it's
And I'm choosing this passage because it basically will give you the background as to why I chose to write this particular book. This book examines both what went right in the money game and what we might learn from the many ways it went astray. It poses tough questions that challenge our shared beliefs. It isn't intended to change minds so much as invite them to question for themselves and decide what they know to be right. Page. It is, at rock bottom, a love story, an ode to our wild, wonderful, wacky human experience. I honor us all for our willingness to be feeling, thinking rats running through this experimental laboratory maze we call life. We are indeed the trailblazers, the unsung heroes, the warriors, and the courageous world explorers. We are the ones who are being called upon now to trust each other and trust in a higher evolutionary process as we give ourselves over to adventures in the unknown. We are the surprisingly patient, kind-hearted, and occasionally very frightened ones. Yet we nevertheless keep bravely soldiering on. We are the ones who have, over eons, learned to feel sorrow, to worry, to dream, to imagine, to share, to create, to express, to give freely of ourselves to those we love. We are the ones who have only just lately realized we are capable of it all, from mass destruction to unconditional love. And we are the ones who must live with that terrible wisdom. We are, in fact, the ones we've been waiting for, our own Messiah. Not a one, but a multitude of amazing ones. Because we can create it all, it's up to us to decide, right now, what we wish to create for ourselves, and then create it.
May I ask you a question?
You may. We love to do Socratic dialogues.
Because what you read and what we spoke about before we came, how money is a proxy for true wealth and is a substitute for trusting each other. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Most of us, in fact, I would venture to guess everybody in the room has worked for money.
Would you come up here?
Yes, I will. So the way that I have come to understand money and how money works through a lot of research and understanding, just working in the business and seeing how it functions, is that it's not true wealth. It never was true wealth. Money is a proxy for true wealth, which are natural resources, real things that we can use, your home, the food that you eat, the clothes that you wear, the things that we need to survive and thrive as a species. All money is an opportunity for us to acquire those things. It's like a permission slip that we've given to each other. And what is it giving us permission to do? It gives us permission to access the goods and services that other people have produced. Well, why do we need a permission slip? We need a permission slip because somewhere along the way, we chose not to trust each other anymore. We engaged in a process of indirect gifting because direct gifting doesn't particularly work. If I'm growing corn and this lady here is building cabinets and I don't want cabinets but she wants corn but I want the pig that he's got over here, then somehow we have to make that trade work. And we started with bartering and that got very cumbersome. And so we created this thing called money to facilitate that trade, and it was a way of measuring how the trades were going, so that we made sure that everybody was doing their part. I had no way of knowing whether my friend here actually gave the cabinets to the gentleman here, but if he had money or she had money and came to me, I could assume that they did some work somewhere else. So we were all putting our energy into the system. And that was the original intent of the monetary system, was to make sure that everybody was playing fairly. Well, what's happened as we fast forward literally thousands of years, is it's gotten way off track from that. It's no longer just that. It's become something that we use to measure our self-worth. And we're marketing and valuing each other based upon what we think somebody else's job is worth. And for me, that's a fundamental problem. Because when you step back and you look at how we value each other, rather than allowing us to value ourselves based upon what it is that we have inside of us that is unique and special to each individual and enabling us to bring that forth, we are diverting people's energies into these roles that may or may not be the roles they were destined to play, but that generate money so that you can buy the things you need so you can play in the system. Does that make sense? Everybody following? So there's a fundamental challenge with that process in that when we look at money from that perspective, it's not enabling or empowering us in any way to be the best that we can become. It's actually become limiting in that we only get it if we do the certain things that our society has already decreed have value. And what is it that our society has decreed has value? Making stuff. Making stuff. Well, to some extent, making stuff has value. We know that. It's good to have a certain amount of stuff. But there are lots and lots and lots of things that we need to do that have nothing to do with making stuff, and everything to do with how happy we are in life and how connected we are to the world and how reverent we are to our world. And when we get caught up in this concept of making stuff as the only thing that has worth, we miss out on things like taking care of the planet. Who's cleaning up the mess? That's a job that doesn't get paid for because it doesn't make stuff.
So, and we can go on and on. We look at the way that we're depleting our natural resources because we're so busy converting natural resources to commodities that we can sell and throw away so we can get more of these little green slips of paper. And when you just step back for a minute and look at that, say, what are we doing? We're destroying our natural resources so that we can get more of these little chits to go out and play the game and buy stuff. And if you think about that, there's an absurdity to it, and it's actually rather tragic because we can make more slips of paper anytime we want, but we can't make more natural resources if we deplete them faster than their natural replenishment rate. So this notion of needing to continue to produce and make stuff for the sake of money, which is what we've all been doing, has put us on a very, very tight treadmill, and we've lost touch with the larger scope of what it is that we're in.
Does anyone have a question?
Just a comment. Mm-hmm. In the discussion before about what brings joy and meaning, no one mentioned stuff.
That was phenomenal to me. Not only did not mention stuff, nobody mentioned making money.
Right.
Nobody said, what brings me joy is getting rich, or what brings me joy is having a Ferrari when my neighbor only has a Toyota. But that's the system that we've been designed and embedded to believe is what we're here to do.
Okay, question.
I think you undervalue other values in our culture. More than half of our economy is services.
Oh yeah.
There's an enormous part of our economy is nonprofits and charitable giving. You devalue that.
I don't devalue it at all. I don't devalue it.
You underestimate it.
Here's what I would say, as I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate the comment. I think a lot of the service things that we do wind up being in service to the people that have money. They're not necessarily in service to the people that don't have money. The way that a free market system works, which is a supply and demand system, and that's what we have bought into and said that we want, is that there's supposed to be dynamic balance that takes place. The supply gets created based upon the demand. And the understanding, the conceptual understanding, which works well on paper, is that if a lot of people want a particular product, a business will find a way to create it, and there'll be a price that works out that's fair, that the business can make a profit and the people can buy it. What gets left out of that equation is the people that want a product but don't have money to begin with. The poor people never get a voice in that particular transaction because nobody cares what they want because they can't afford it anyway.
In your book, you talked about nonprofits, charities, almost being like capitalism in that there's the haves and the have-nots. There's the, we have what you need, so we're going to give what you need to you, and there's an inequity about that in terms of valuing each other. And you've also identified that poverty is created by the for-profit system. So the fact that nonprofits exist, need to exist, I mean, can you talk about what's under that? Because you can talk about what's under that better than me. The fact that nonprofits exist casts aspersions on the capitalistic system.
Yeah, you brought up a couple of good points there. There's a couple of things I would say about that. When we start looking at the capitalistic paradigm and how it works, I would say that the notion of poverty didn't exist until we came on the scene with a monetary system.
Right.
If you went back 2,000 years ago into Africa and you asked the African people, are you poor? They would have said, no, we weren't poor at all. They were living off the land. They were using the resources they had. They didn't have televisions and they didn't have, you know, refrigerators or certain things, but they did not consider themselves poor. What created poverty was the energy of exploitation from certain countries that had a capitalistic overtone and a monetaristic system, and they went into these third world countries, claimed the assets for their own, moved the people into communities that couldn't support or sustain them, took the assets, used that to ship them back home and make themselves wealthy, and then suddenly there's pockets of poverty everywhere.
That's really not true. anthropological studies show that between different bands of hunters and gatherers, they're competing with each other. Some of them are relatively impoverished, and some of them are very wealthy. You're just ignoring history.
Well, maybe you should read the book, and I can talk about it afterwards, because there's a lot of information in the book. I'll just ask you.
You're just simplifying things from a post-industrial point of view.
Let me speak to where we are now. Where we are now as a society is we are looking at the potential global collapse of our economic system. We're looking at near bankruptcy. Most countries in the world are bankrupt, they just haven't admitted it yet. So most dollars and currencies are pretty much worthless. We're looking at a world where we have devastated the natural resources and used them faster than their natural replenishment rate. We're looking at a world where what we have done has impacted the climate in a negative way. We're looking at the sixth great extinction event in this planet, where animals are dying and plants are dying in absolute record numbers, because we're busy making money and making products to sell to each other so that we can feel wealthy. We are totally ignoring the message of reality because our minds are in this box of what it is we think we're doing economically. And none of it serves the joy that we talked about earlier. So whether we want to debate history and what's happened in history, or whether we want to debate how money works, that's the reality that we're all sitting here in right now, is that in 20 to 50 years, if we haven't changed the way that we're doing business with each other, if we're still quarreling over whether we should have austerity measures or whether we should pin money to a gold standard, and keeping our dialogue focused on these little bits of paper that we're creating and these little digital things, the reality is that reality is going to move on without us, and we're going to render ourselves extinct. And we're not going to kill the planet, we can't. She's bigger and greater than any of us. But we can certainly destroy our capacity to thrive on this planet, and we're doing a good job of that right now with the way that we're functioning. So that's the place that I'm coming from, looking at that and saying, do we want to keep doing that? Is that what we want to keep doing?
Do you believe that money is evil?
No, I don't believe anything is evil. I believe only in ignorance. To me, what we call evil is somebody who doesn't understand that everything is integrally connected and everything is alive, and that there should be a reverence for all things on this planet. I don't believe in evil at all. I have evolutionary perspective. Here's what I would say, is that if we see a baby that has sharp fingernails and doesn't know how to coordinate its hands, and it scratches its face and draws blood, we don't say the baby is bad. We say it hasn't figured out that it's coordinated and it's one dynamic unit. And we don't punish it, and we don't make it wrong. We clip its nails and put mittens on it and wait for it to mature its own consciousness till it understands its deep connectivity. And that's how I see the things that people are doing in the world that are ignorant, that are problematic for this planet. It's just that their consciousness has not yet stepped into that space of knowing that everything is connected, and that it's all one living dynamic system, and that it's all alive.
Yes?
What directions are you wanting to go?
What directions am I suggesting? I believe it's organic. I believe that what's happening now is there's a rising within individuals, and a knowing that's happening on the level of consciousness.
And one point, and that is maturing from adolescent to adult.
Yeah, my sense of it is that we're an adolescent species, and that the species is mirroring the growth path of a typical individual. And I think you can bear that out just by looking at how we function as a species. We're aggressive, we're narcissistic, we're self-absorbed, we're insecure, we need external validation, we work off punishment and reward. All of these things, that we're cliquish, we're judgmental, we're fear-based, we're not comfortable in our own bodies, that's an adolescent mindset. And that's the mindset of the entire society writ large, not every individual, but just the larger society consciousness, no matter what the age of the individual is. So my sense of it is that what's happening is consciousness is beginning to awaken in people and transfer people, or tip people into an adult level consciousness one person at a time. And as that happens, the overarching consciousness of the society will rise to a higher level of adult perspective, and we're going to begin to concern ourselves with engaging on levels of intimacy and cooperative ventures and being able to delay gratification and exercise self-discipline and all of those things that are the hallmarks of an adult behavior. So my sense is that there's not going to be a formula that we can use and say, this is how we're going to get from here to there. It's going to be self-evolving and organic as more and more people step into their adult consciousness. Any question?
No, just okay. This class is an example of the maturation of the human species. So the direction that we're going in is the direction that you're going in. That's all I have to say right now.
Just occurred to me that in terms of the dynamics of change, I think we would all agree here, and most rational people would agree that change is needed in terms of our values and for our planet. And just, we're so conscious of those in the world who are suffering as we've never been before. I like Barbara Marx Hubbard's concept of increasing consciousness. It strikes me that there's a harshness in your indictment of us, you know, and I think the first reaction is to defend ourselves, like, we're not really that bad, you know. And I wonder if you run into this, because there are a lot of really caring people in this world, but there's a kind of indictment that I sense raises a certain defensiveness.
Yeah, I feel that sometimes too. It's not intentional. I think it's not personal. This is not personal. In fact, our system is not designed by you and me. You didn't choose it. We were born into this system, and we're trying to break out of it primarily because we've outgrown it. Capitalism is not evil. Capitalism wasn't bad. Capitalism was a wonderful growth engine for an adolescent species. And that's what an adolescent does. It grows rapidly. It consumes a whole lot of stuff. It explores and experiences, and it's very self-centered. And that's exactly what the capitalistic system did. As we're now approaching species adulthood, we're getting to a point where accelerated growth becomes morbid obesity. And that's what's true for adults. At some point, you can't eat 12 peanut butter sandwiches for lunch. You're going to get fat, and you're going to kill yourself. So there's just a realization that as we move through our own species growth, we've circumnavigated the planet, we've settled everything, we now have machines and fossil fuels and technology to do a lot of our work, we don't need to work 40 hours a day anymore. The fact that we're continuing to do so is a function of we're following an old formula that's outmoded.
Yeah, this still.
So what is your solution to this? Can you go back to thousands of years ago?
No, I don't think the solution is ever going back. There's a reason we're leaving behind.
What are you really saying?
As we go forward, what I'm suggesting, as we become more mature as individuals and more capable and more aware of what reality is telling us, because right now I think we're so caught up in our mind games as a species, we're not paying as much attention to reality as we could. And reality doesn't care if we can afford to clean up after a disaster or not. It really doesn't. It's going to throw challenges our way and say, deal with them. You adapt or die. And that's the way evolution works. And let me go back. I'm sorry. I'll answer your question. What am I suggesting that we do? I'm suggesting that we shift the way that we engage with each other from the need to earn a financial profit off of each other by changing the definition of profit and say, we still want to earn a profit, but what does profit mean? Profit means what's beneficial for the planet. What is good for life? What is healthy for our well-being as a species? What is reverent toward the living systems in which we are operating and the ecosystems that we have?
So what I'm hearing you say is that we're destroying ourselves.
Yes.
And we're destroying ourselves by increasing our standard of living. Forget financial, through medicine, through education, through the good for the rest of the people. I don't understand what you mean. I too come from the same background you do, and I don't agree with you.
Yeah, I
see the world the only reason we see all these things you're saying is the ability to hear all this information instantaneously. We now have communication at our fingertips. We hear things that are happening in Africa at the instant it happens. We're hearing things that are happening all over, and we are being told by the news media what they want to tell us. And I see the world today is a much better place than it's ever been. I see us going forward. Look at our ages here. We're living a much longer life. We're living a much healthier life. And this is just a group of individuals here, but that's over the whole world. There are many centurions now. We never had that before.
Can I ask?
Do we need money to continue that?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Because nobody is going to work for nothing. We're not going to go and become a community. People need rewards in order to achieve. Even looking at the achievements in medicine, people that do this get rewarded. The rewards can be notoriety, they can be financial, they can be whatever. Yes.
Okay.
And it's the old theory of paraboy. And I don't see that changing.
Here's what I would suggest.
Sure.
Is that as we mature, I don't know about you, but when I became an adult, nobody gave me an attaboy for cleaning my toilets. I had to give myself my attaboys when I did that. And when I take out the trash at home, and when I raise my kids, and when I put food on the table.
You're on a different plateau. I mean, I don't see what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that it's possible.
Things that, not what you do for yourself, but what you do for everyone else.
And there's also, I don't know, I raised kids. I did a lot for other people. I went through years where my children did not even like me as a parent. And I had to continue to self-validate and do the hard work of raising a child because within that was joy. And my suggestion is that if in fact we need external validation in order to do the things we do, then maybe we're doing the wrong things. Because when you come from a place of love and joy and understanding that what you're doing is helpful for the world, maybe we don't need as much external reward as we think we do. There's a great book by a guy by the name of Dan Pink called Drive. And in that book, he talks about the fundamental drivers that motivate people. And they've done sociological studies for over 50 years. And the one thing that he has found out is that reward and punishment, which are external motivators, are the least successful ways to reward human beings. That we have intrinsic drivers within us that are being subdued by the external imposition of punishment and reward. So to the extent that we are subjugating our internal drivers to the need for reward and punishment, we're actually limiting our capacity to be the best we can be. Now the three drivers he talks about that are intrinsic to all human beings are the desire for autonomy. Everybody wants to be the manager of their own reality, to control their own time and their own destiny. And that's just a fundamental truth. The second driver is the desire for personal mastery. When you have a skill set or a particular passion or talent that is moving within you, you want to be the best at it that you know how to be. And you will work very, very hard without somebody having to pay you to do that particular skill set until you become a master of it. Nobody's ever paid me for writing. I've been writing for years and years because I can't not write until I have mastered the skill of writing, and I continue to try and master that skill. The third and final thing that we all have intrinsically within ourselves that we desire is the desire to serve a higher purpose than the self. And that is the one that has been the most subverted by the need for external reward and punishment that is part of our adolescent society culture.
So what was the purpose of you writing the book? Wasn't it to sell?
No, I'm giving it away. You can go on my website and download it for free. The only reason I'm selling it in paperback form is because I have to pay for it. I'm part of that system. And I sell it for a sliding scale based on what it costs me and then what anybody else wants to donate. So I can go around and do these things. But I walk my talk.
What's the website? SacredEconomics.org. What do you think of ideal communism?
My sense of communism is it has never been tried in an adult community. It has always been tried in an adolescent society that has been a power dominator, authoritarian system. You cannot superimpose communism on people's psyches. So, I'm not an ism person anyway. I don't believe in any ism except organism. That's the only ism I cop to, is I'm part of a living organism, and I am a particular cell in this large planetary organism, and if my body tried to function the way we try to function as a species, it would die in about 5 minutes. I mean, can you imagine your liver cell going to your blood cell and going, hey, I hear you've got some toxins you need to drop off, that would be $4.95, and the blood cell going, well, yeah, but you need food, that's going to be $6.95. You know, how long would your body function as a structurally integral organism if, in fact, that was the kind of negotiating that was going on in your system? But that's the way we're treating each other, because we don't see each other as cells in a larger body. We see each other as separate. You're different and distinct from me. And when I make that separation, I can exploit you for personal gain. I can take advantage of the world for personal gain. And I can't make those same decisions if my consciousness moves to that different level where I see everything as interwoven and interconnected in one unified field that's living and relevant, worth relevant. So that's the shift.
As far as what are the practical steps maybe that we could take to make the biggest difference now? Have you seen the movie Thrive? And if you have, what do you think about it?
I actually have not seen the whole movie. I've worked with Foster Gamble for a while, and I know the theory behind it, but I have not taken the time to actually sit down and watch it yet. I know parts of it that I think are very good, and there's some questions in there I have about, you know, some of the conspiracy kinds of things that I'm a little less attuned to.
Because what I'm getting, and it's very powerful, I want to get your book out of it, but I'm hearing a lot of stuff that can transform the world coming from the inside of us and living it out.
Right. Yes.
But in that movie, there are a number of things that are suggested to sort of, one step at a time, kind of change the system so that the whole thing doesn't collapse and there's a lot of extra hardship in the meantime.
I don't know if we have any control over that, because my sense is that we are experiencing the evolution of evolution itself right now, that evolution is evolving, and that historically evolution has always required crisis and suffering to create transformation. And I believe that the infusion of self-aware consciousness into the material realm gives us the freedom to now evolve without having to suffer first. That we can have the foresight and the wisdom and the opportunity to see the need to evolve and make good decisions without having to be kicked in the butt to get there. So this may be the last time, if we do this and we get through it, that suffering has to precede transformation. We may in the future be able to transform simply because we're curious about what else we might be able to do, and we have a desire to see if we can do something different.
And nobody has the answer. Nobody has the answer. This is a collective thing. We need everybody's light as to how to go forward and how we can support the living organism, how we can support ourselves as the newest, youngest experimental species on the larger organism of our planet. We're an experiment of nature. Nobody has the answer to how we should step by step move from the overpopulation and pollution and all that stuff to begin exchanging life with each other in ways that don't create poverty and that don't create war, and our economic system, our for-profit machinery has created the wars and poverty. The for-profit motive, for personal profit motive, I'm going to put one in and take two out. That's why it's collapsing.
Thank you.
There have been some attempts to reform the monetary system by setting up local currencies that represent hours of exchange, mm-hmm. and San Diego still has one.
Yeah, we have that too now.
Well, I think the entire monetary system does need reform, because right now it's all based on debt and it's all attached with interest, and it creates a tremendous, I mean, basically, if you look at what we have to do now, you have to dig a hole to develop the competency to go out into the world and become something and make something of yourself, and then you got to fill in the hole to get back to ground level. That just seems to me ridiculous. Why not start at ground level and work your way up? But we make our kids go, you know, $200,000 in debt to get a college education.
That's not true, but I asked you a question about what do you think of these local monetary systems?
I think they're great, because the local monetary systems don't use a debt-based system. They are actually capitalizing upon that which is infinite, which is human creativity and human capacity. So when you capitalize human creativity and human capacity, rather than tie your monetary system to something that is scarce, we enable and empower ourselves to exchange, because that's really what currency is supposed to do. It's supposed to create flow between individuals. And what we have right now are literally billions of people who have things to offer, and there's no money out there to buy it from them, so everybody's sitting idle going, what do? We got people out of work, and we have so much work to do on this planet. But there's no money in the right pockets to move that energy from point A to point B. So we are consciously or subconsciously damning our own creativity, waiting for somebody to give us the permission slips that we need to access the other things so that we can go out and do the work that needs to be done. And who's deciding what work needs to be done? The people that have all the money. They're the ones who decide what's going to get made and where resources are going to go, and the rest of us just sort of go along with that, because that's the way we've always played the game.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, we have to be mature, mm-hmm. or we have to move from the adolescent behaviors into the adult.
Yes.
Could you tell me how you do that?
Well, how did you do it when you were a teenager?
Huh?
How did you do it when you were a teenager?
You know, I don't know. I couldn't even figure it out. I'm getting 70 now.
I think it's a muddle through process. Part of it is, I can say as a parent watching my children go through adolescence and having gone through adolescence myself, part of the challenge is giving the children the capacity to make mistakes, to screw up, to be incompetent, to take risks and fail, and then discover their own innate competency through trial and error. And I think that's the kind of break we're going to have to cut ourselves as a society, is say we're going to have to try a lot of different things. And we may try some economic systems and some monetary systems that don't work, but that doesn't mean that you go running backwards and, you know, back into what you used to be. It means you just say, okay, that's a good lesson. Now we know what doesn't work. We will figure out what does work by learning what doesn't work. That's how science works. So we're going to have to treat ourselves like a giant science experiment, and cut ourselves some slack as we experiment with different ways of being in relationship with each other. But fundamentally, I think what it's going to come down to is the maturation of the collective consciousness, the realization that we don't need rewards and punishments to keep us on the straight and narrow, that we're perfectly capable of self-rewarding and recognizing that we've done something that is not in our highest and best state, and correcting along the way.
You have a question.
Okay, you have a question.
Well, in all this answer, I'm just curious as to what questions you're asking from where you are now. What are you unsure of? What are your questions as opposed to what are your answers for the rest of us?
I have lots of questions. I have absolutely no idea how this is going to unfold. I mean, I am in the unknown with everybody else. I'm asking questions like, you know, what's going to happen to the global money supply? What's that impact going to be on humanity? What's going to happen if we don't address some of these incredible challenges that are facing us as a species? I don't know. How far do we have to fall into suffering and disarray and chaos before we figure out that we need to do something different? I don't know. What is that something different going to look like? I don't know. All I can tell you is that the energy and the experience that I've had as part of my own spiritual awakening is that the only answer that feels real and good and true for me is to continually be cognizant of the fact that it's one unified field, and it's all alive, and it's all interconnected, and that anything that we do to support and elevate another elevates us, And anything that we do to diminish another diminishes ourselves. And that's what I fall back on. I look at it, I'll tell you a story, is when I had my wife, it was a breakdown. I mean, I had an absolute mental breakdown. And I would define it as like a picture frame. My whole life had been a picture frame or a jigsaw puzzle frame. And people had given me the framework. You get pieces as you go through life. The teacher tells you something, you put it in the corner and you start building this little frame. And you gather pieces as you go. And eventually, one day, I realized I started to get these pieces that didn't fit the picture. And there's a couple things you can do. But the thing I did was put them to the side and say, well, maybe I'll figure out later on where those pieces go, because I got to keep building my little puzzle. And then more and more pieces came in that didn't fit the puzzle. And eventually, I had more pieces outside the puzzle than inside the puzzle. And that was an enormous problem. And I had what I would call a cognitive dissonance to the nth degree, and I had a complete shattering of my understanding of reality. I had to blow it all up. The entire framework of what I believed was true about reality had to go. And I went back to zero. I didn't believe anything. And from that point forward, what became very clear to me was I don't want to build a bigger picture frame, because I'm just going to have to keep blowing them up, because new information comes in all the time and I don't know. So the only place from which I can ever start is center. And from here on out, whenever I do anything, I start at center and work my way out. And if I start to get lost or confused, I just roll back into center. And where is center? What is center? Center is what I know to be true, that it's one unified field of life and that we're all connected, and that anything I do to help someone is helping me, and anything I do to harm someone harms me. That's the singular truth that I fall back on all the time. And then I go out again. And I would invite other people to give some consideration to that process, because I'm not looking forward to having the entire society have to blow up its picture frame all in one fell swoop. I've done it once, it's not fun. I don't want to do it together as a collective. I prefer that we all find graceful ways to let go of some of these beliefs that are not serving.
Maybe a big piece of it is fear, mm-hmm. and letting go of, as you described, the system that we've created, which is about maybe letting go of our stuff. And I was laid off from work. I happened to work for the second largest defense company in the country. I was laid off 2.5 years ago. And I haven't made a dime from work since then, really. From investments, yes, some. But a lot of that has been lost because of the stock thing. And I've had to scale back so much in terms of material things, things that cost money. And I have to say from the bottom of my heart, with all my spirit, and coming here and sharing all this is a huge part of it. It has been the best 2.5 years of my life.
Yeah. I will agree with you. I mean, I lost $several million in the stock market because I worked for Citigroup with the brokerage firm Smith Barney that was owned by Citigroup, and I had all kinds of restricted stock and stock options. And of course, when the stock went from 60 to 3, my entire retirement that I had done all the right things and saved for went away, literally vanished, because my options were accelerated and had to expire, and I had the expired worthless, and all of a sudden I found myself with absolutely no retirement savings, no safety net, and I said, okay, if I have to go be a bag lady and eat out of trash bins, so be it, but I'm not going to go back into that system and participate in a way that is not loving and kind and bringing sustenance to this planet. I just won't.
That's what I decided too, and my friends who are holding on to what they have and trying to invest more and save more, and, God bless them, I just say to them, there is some fear in me, of course, still, and I only ask that if ever you see me on the streets, like on State Street, and I'm not asking you to take care of me in the future, but maybe just a cup of coffee, maybe just a cappuccino every week. I mean, seriously, I'm willing, because of the choices I'm making now, if that is my destiny, then so be it. This is worth it.
Absolutely.
That's right. Freedom.
And I'll tell you, the irony for me has been that the more that I have let go and given away, the more comes in. It's astounding to me. Every time I start thinking, this process is crazy, why am I trusting that the universe is going to take care of me? Something weird and bizarre and wonderful happens and falls, and suddenly I have more to give away. I cannot give away what's been coming in fast enough to impoverish myself. I may eventually, my house is going on the market this next 2 weeks, so we'll see where that goes. But, I've been blessed by being able to trust.
And can I share too, because I've always worked in the nonprofit world, so I've never really been out for money that much. The most I've ever made is when I was in the post office is 34,000 a year. I came here and now I live in I live in subsidized housing, so I live off of my $1,052 a month. But things like a friend gave me money to go to South Africa for a month. I had lunch with a friend a month ago and helped her in the crisis that she was having while we sat there and talked, and she sent me a $1,000 check. I mean, these kinds of things. You know, Eileen, went, she and her husband went to Las Vegas and she got $800 in the slot machine and she gave me three. I mean, those are the kinds of things. I mean, it's like when you put the universe first, you are the universe in person. When you put your own love of everything first, the universe provides. And I want to live in that economic system. I don't want to live in the other one. But we're in transition. It's not this or that, because this is the crossover generation, as Barbara Marx Hubbard says. So we're having to experiment.
Let me just add too that if you download the book, which you can download for free at www.sacredeconomics.org, every chapter in that book takes a look at a myth of capitalism and deconstructs it. The things we've been taught to believe without question. I'm looking at them and questioning and saying, do we really want to hold this belief? And then at the end of each chapter, I give common sense ways that we can begin to release those beliefs and practice different behaviors. For example, in the chapter about ownership versus stewardship, I talk about things like, you know, rather than us trying to sell things all the time, we have so much that we have in terms of capabilities and skills that are free. So if you can teach somebody how to make jelly, you're passing on a skill that's a beautiful skill, and you're getting the benefit of sharing your wisdom with somebody who's going to carry that forward. It doesn't have to be a monetary exchange. Why does it have to be that? If your neighbor has a tree that the fruit's falling on the ground and you know how to do something with it, go over and say, can I pick up your fruit and I'll give you a pie in exchange, you know? Do those kinds of things. So there are practical practices that we can implement that inch us away from that need to see every single engagement with another human being as a monetary transaction.
Sri Aurobindo says, nature advances by constant approximations, partial realizations, and temporary successes. This is a much more humble approach to the organism that life is. It's not this, yeah, but what do we want to set up? It's like, no, nature advances by constant approximations, partial realizations, and temporary successes. You had a question?
What about the people that have similar ideas?
That's exactly what we're trying to do. We have a third Sunday of every month at Aini Gallery. We have a Sacred Economics group workshop where we're bringing people together and inviting people to do boots on the ground kind of activities. So we definitely want to find new ways to be in relationship and explore different ideas that people have. So you're invited to come to that and put your idea in the middle and see what we can do.
And how much of politics is involved in that?
None.
We're not into politics.
But if you are not involved in politics, you should have no interest in it whatsoever. And politics right now
are locked, are dysfunctional.
It's dysfunctional, still
very much. Well, yeah, but it's part of the same adolescent consciousness. You've got the power dominator systems that are battling each other. you know, the overprotective mommy side of politics and the stern, you know, punishing father side of politics, and we're still acting like children. So ultimately, I think it was Buckminster Fuller who said, you don't change the system by fighting it. You change it by rendering it obsolete when you create a brand new system. And that's the key, is rather than continue to do, you know, occupy, fight, and resist, we have to experiment on the community level with different ways of being in relationship and let those flow upward. And ultimately, it will render obsolete the power dominator structures that have been treating us like children.
We have time for one more question.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Ultimately, you mentioned that at this moment, there are at least 2 billion people, their life is at stake.
Yeah, but that's always the risk. Is you take a step into the abyss, and the other side isn't necessarily there for you to see. So when we talk about faith, many people talk about faith and having faith. To me, this is a true test of faith, is can you step into a new reality without having absolute certainty that you're going to land on firm ground, and being able to trust that if enough of us step together and we link arms, we're going to get across. But it's very, very difficult to do it one at a time. That's why we want to have these community discussions.
Well, one question and then that's it.
Just a couple comments. Father Max Hubbard, who is local here in New San Marco, does have one of the spokes on her wheels that she is addressing is economics. And there is a local group working on that with her. And I'm getting more information on that. Also, there's a newly formed party called the Justice Party. There's a presidential candidate named Rocky Anderson, whose platform is based on economics and cleaning that up. So keep an eye on that.
Thanks.
It's an independent party and it's just started in December. So, but he's getting a lot of momentum, and that is tied entirely with politics. And
all right, it's noon. The class time has come to an end. Thank you all very much.